Hi, I'm Tim Lee. I'm a Princeton alum and a technology reporter at Vox.com. I'm joined by Matt Silganik and Pratik Patel, both Princeton professors who study the effects of digital technology on society. This is a preview of a bigger conversation we'll be having in Berlin in March at Princeton's FUNG Global Forum. So Matt, you've been doing research and you recently wrote a book about the ethical implications of collecting large amounts of data, which computers and the internet allow us to do more than ever before. Having a lot of data allows us to do a lot of new things with it, both in terms of scientific research and in terms of, you know, running programs and more effectively, but there are also some potential downsides. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. So we see a lot of excitement in the popular press about big data, and I think all of that, a lot of that excitement is justified in the sense that it really does allow new kinds of services to be provided, and it allows for new kinds of scientific research. But I do think that it is a little bit less appreciated that it also enables new forms of essentially mass surveillance. And I think there have been a number of cases already where researchers and governments have not fully appreciated what the consequences of that kind of surveillance and data capabilities can be. So there have been examples where people have taken data that they thought was anonymized, tried to make it available to other researchers, and then it turned out that that data wasn't really as anonymous as people thought.
And Pratik, you've been doing a lot of thinking about this specific question, about if you have a big set of data and you want to make it available in aggregate form, whether it's possible to hide individual information about individual people in a way that preserves privacy. What has your research found?
Right, great question. So I think at Princeton, I've been thinking about the design of mechanisms and computational platforms that allow machine learning analytics over big data while protecting the privacy of sensitive user data. So we've been using techniques from the domain of statistical data privacy, such as differential privacy, that obfuscate data. And by obfuscating data, I mean by injecting noise in data, in a way that untrusted applications are provably limited in their ability to make sensitive inferences about users in the database. The problem is still very challenging because there is a fundamental tension between the privacy of data and the utility of these big data applications that Matt talked about. But for certain types of applications, it has been shown that this tension can be favorably resolved.
Maybe I could give an example of concrete things that can go wrong if people don't use the techniques that Pratik was describing.
Yeah, that would be great.
So one well-known example in this community comes from the America Online search log release. So this was in the mid-2000s, and America Online had a search engine. And through that search engine, they were collecting lots of data about what people were searching for. Researchers realized that this data could be very helpful to other scientists to try to improve how search engines work and potentially reveal other important information about society. So a few years after this, Google, for example, was able to combine their search logs with data from the Centers for Disease Control to improve influenza surveillance. So these researchers at AOL said, hey, we have all this great data. Let's make it available to others. And that seems like a wonderful intent. And they realized they removed people's sort of names that were and their IP addresses that were part of this log. And so they had thought they had made the data anonymous, and then they released it. And very soon after that, computer scientists figured out that actually the data wasn't as anonymous as people thought. And in fact, a reporter from the New York Times, looking through the search logs, was able to go to a town in Georgia and find one of the people in the logs.
And that had a pretty big scandal, and I think that made companies a lot more reluctant to release this kind of data.
Absolutely, yeah. The head of the AOL research was fired, and everyone in a company who is in a position to make data available knows this story. And I would also say it's not just, and I think that there are also really good reasons why companies should not release this data, right? It's not, as this particular story illustrates, it's turned out to be very difficult to anonymize data. And companies, you know, I would not want my phone company to be releasing my call record because, it's very difficult to anonymize them, even though I know that researchers could do a lot of really good stuff with my call records. Not mm-hmm. just my personal records, but all call records in aggregate would be a really valuable data set.
Right. So we've been talking so far about cases where, you know, a company or an organization releases a data set explicitly for research. Are there cases where companies release information either kind of in the ordinary course or accidentally leak information that...
One example that comes to mind for me is some of the government open data, which, again, I think the intention is wonderful. The idea is that governments are collecting enormous amounts of data as well. It's not mm-hmm. just companies. And if that data is collected by the government, then in some sense, some of that data sort of belongs to society. And so it's, I think, a wonderful goal to make the information that government has more easily available to the public, to hold government accountable, and also so that that information can be reused to other, you know, for research, for new products, new services. So, for example, New York City has taxi data, all the meters in New York. They record, you know, the start location and the stop location and start time and stop time of each trip. Mm-hmm. And the city has been releasing this information and someone has discovered. So this seems like potentially very safe information. There's no one's name. There's no one's address, telephone number. There's in some ways nothing even about people, right? It's all about taxi trips. Mm-hmm. But someone has realized that you can essentially select out of this all the trips that begin at, say, the Hustler Club, which is a well-known strip club in New York, mm-hmm. Saturday between midnight and 5 a.m. And then you can see where those taxi rides end. And so through this, you can potentially figure out who goes to the strip club, or at least have more information about it. And this is not just the strip club. You could put in any other location that you want. So it could be visits to people going to medical clinics, religious sites, anything, any place in the city. So here, I don't think the city had any bad intention. And it's just that it's hard to make this data available and protect the privacy of the people in it.
So Pratik, your research focuses on how to, so there's basic tension of either you release the data or you don't, but your research is about how to release the data in a way that preserves more anonymity than you would if you just did the kind of simple thing. What can we do and what are the limits of the kind of techniques that you and other researchers have looked at?
Actually, before I get to the question, I wanted to just illustrate another example that builds upon some of the examples that Matt gave that illustrates that with emerging technologies and paradigms such as the Internet of Things and smartphone communications, some of these privacy challenges will be magnified. So for example, in our recent research at Princeton, we uncovered a new attack on privacy that takes advantage of innocuous sensors that are now pervasive and inbuilt into our smartphone ecosystem. So they come in with sensors, including accelerometers and gyroscopes and biometers for air pressure readings. And it turns out that any smartphone application that's installed on your phone has default access to many of this sensor information. So it does not even require the user to explicitly provide permission, that these permissions are there by default. And what we found was that a malicious application could take advantage of this information and combine it with machine learning technologies and with publicly available data sets, such as Google Map data sets, to precisely infer your location and track that location over time.
Oh, wow.
There's a very, very strong correlation between air pressure readings and these accelerometer sensors and Google Open Maps data. So indeed, with new and emerging technologies, many of these threats will become worse. In terms of how to mitigate some of these challenges, the first step is to be aware of what is the attack surface of privacy, especially with respect to new and emerging technologies. And that by itself is extremely challenging because we are still just scratching the surface of, you know, what is possible with machine learning and what is possible with signal processing technologies. But we've seen some promising recent results. So there was one example that I want to highlight in particular, And this is the example of Google's implementation of differential privacy in their Chrome web browser. So if you're using Google's Chrome web browser, you're actually participating in the statistical privacy deployment. Now, Google was very interested to learn information about their users' homepage statistics, which is the default Chrome page that you go to. And this information was very useful for Google's security team in particular. So this is an example of one of the big data applications that Matt mentioned. But of course, users' homepage is also extremely sensitive information, and this is something we'd like to protect the privacy of. So Google actually deployed the very promising technology that I mentioned earlier, differential privacy. And before giving this data to Google, the web browser obfuscates this data. So it injects scalar noise to the sensor data. In this case, the sensor is just your homepage, before sending it out to Google. And by aggregating this noisy data, aggregating these noisy statistics over time and across users, Google can build a very accurate map of the homepage distribution without learning anything about the individual user.
I think Pratik raised something that I'd like to follow up on a little bit, because it's something I've see some confusion about sometimes, is about what is sensitive and what is not sensitive. And I think this is something that our intuitions aren't well suited for. Our intuitions that come from the analog age are not necessarily well suited. So he said someone's homepage is sensitive information. And some of the listeners may be thinking, well, my homepage isn't very sensitive. I don't see why that could be considered sensitive. And I think it's important to keep in mind that as the size of the data set grows, the likelihood that there is information in that data that is sensitive to someone increases. So your particular homepage, you may not consider that to be sensitive, but let's say we have the homepages of 1 million people or 1 billion people. Within that huge group of people, there are going to be people for whom that information is sensitive. So I think a wonderful example of this comes from the Netflix Prize, which was another example of a data release that people thought was anonymized properly and turned out not to be. So Netflix had a contest where they released a bunch of movie ratings information from their customers and then challenged data scientists to develop new algorithms that could predict what movie you would like. So it might be in the data that someone likes Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back, and then they would have to try to predict that this person would also like Return of the Jedi. So that was the challenge. And they released the data, again, without any names or addresses or email addresses. But it turned out that with outside information, you could figure out who's, for some of the people, which were their movie ratings. So you may think, oh, my movie ratings are not very sensitive. And that may well be true for you. But there were people in the data set for whom that information was sensitive. So there are people who had, and then there was actually a class action lawsuit about this. And in this lawsuit, the litigants made it clear that their movie ratings revealed information about their sexual orientation, some of them about their history of potentially being abused sexually. So again, the idea of what is sensitive is a very challenging problem. And I think it's safest to assume that in a very, very large data set, there is something that is sensitive to someone, even if it's not sensitive to most people.
That makes sense. So how does the law deal with these kinds of issues? Are there limitations, critique on what kind of data can be released? And if not, should there be cases where there's more rules about this kind of thing?
Right. I think these examples are extremely illustrative to highlight the gap between how technology is progressing and how our laws are actually falling behind in terms of understanding the implications of these technologies. So I should first say that I'm not a lawyer, so please take what I say with a grain of salt. But let's think about how many of our laws are framed today. They often impose stringent regulations in terms of personally identifiable information of users. And this concept of what constitutes a personally identifiable information is very interesting given our discussion so far. So from a legal perspective, it might include things like our name and our social security number, but it might not include the other quasi-identifying information that Matt and I have been referring to. Mm-hmm. Right? So for example, even our social network in many ways can be used to de-anonymize our identity. In the example of Internet of Things and smartphone communications, even the sensored data on our smartphone can be used to track our location and then in turn uniquely identify individuals. So should this information be part of this umbrella term of personally identifying information or not?
I'm not a lawyer either, but I want to build on what Pratik said about our laws are kind of far behind what the technology is capable of now. And here I think that it may make sense to move away from a rules-based approach and move towards more of a principles-based approach, particularly in the setting of research ethics, so university researchers. So for example, we have a set of rules that we are supposed to follow when we undertake research. This is a set of rules called the Common Rule. It's created by the U.S. government, and it was written in 1981. It hasn't changed very much since then. It actually just changed a few days ago, and we'll have to figure out exactly what's happened with that in a minute. But the point is that these rules can't change fast enough to keep up with these new developments. And so it's better potentially to also follow a set of principles where we say these are the sort of general principles that we will try to follow, and then evaluate the specific research ideas in light of these principles. And here we have a lot of a strong tradition of research ethics in social and biomedical sciences that we can draw from. And so they have, and then also combined with ethical principles that have been developed by computer scientists. So together, four principles that we can follow are respect for persons, beneficence, justice, and respect for law and public interest. So the first three of those come from the Belmont Report, which was a blue ribbon panel from the 70s, mostly biomedical and social researchers. And then the last comes from something called the Menlo Report, which was written by computer security researchers in the 2000s.
So can you talk to me about the role of big companies in this? One of the things that strikes me is that, you know, it used to be that researchers would often collect their own data or, you know, through surveys or experiments in a lab or something. Mm-hmm. But nowadays, you have a lot of cases where Google or Facebook or a telephone company or something has just vastly more data than you could hope to collect person. How have those companies thought about, you know, participating or allowing use of their data? Do you think they do a good job? And is there more or less they should be doing to assist with research while protecting user privacy?
Sure. I think this is a great plug for an emerging paradigm that is appearing in the research community. I'm sure that Matt probably touches upon this in his book as well, which is this paradigm of mediated data access. So the idea is that instead of releasing the sensitive data, even in some anonymous form, broadly to the public or broadly to data analysts, which has significant privacy consequences, can we actually bring the data analysis and can we actually bring this experiment to where the data is sitting? So this way, if in the future a flaw is discovered in some particular anonymization algorithm, it doesn't hurt the users of the company significantly because the data is still within the confines of the corporation. So differential privacy, the idea of adding noise to the results of this analysis process, is very closely related to this paradigm of mediated trace access. So in mediated trace access, we are shipping the data analysis to the corporation, and the corporation is only releasing aggregate statistics about users. And in differential privacy, corporations are further introducing some statistical noise to the aggregate query results to even provide provable privacy guarantees. So I believe that this can be a promising paradigm for corporations to broadly benefit society by making their data available while still respecting the privacy constraints that Mac talked about with respect to ethics of data.
So I totally agree with Pratik that mediated access is the way to go. My understanding, and I guess I would like to know what Pratik thinks about this, is that this technology is not easily available to work at an industrial scale yet. And so what I see a lot is, rather than companies releasing data and data going out to researchers, they try to bring researchers to the data. Not so it is a form of mediated access, but it's not a technological form. It's like you get hired by the company, you physically go there, you physically work with the data there, and then you leave. And so I think this solution has some good features in that it allows access to data, and it is, I would guess, relatively strong in terms of the protections that it provides, even if they're not provable guarantees. A challenge, though, is that it's not really scalable. So the number of researchers who would like access to the data that Facebook and Google and many of these companies have far exceeds the number of people who can physically go there, or the number of people that Facebook can physically host. So I think the kinds of solutions that Pratik and his people in his community are developing are really important because they can potentially really scale up this access to the data in a way that's protecting of the users.
Right. I just want to also emphasize Matt's point that scalability is actually an extremely important component of our science. So our science relies on our results being reproducible. And if researchers who are following up on published research do not have access to the original data sets that these companies have, there's no way to reproduce our science. So there's approaches that can scale this technology to the broader research community while still respecting privacy are going to be very important moving forward.
I was going to say, I know this is also a problem that you see in the social science world. Some of the most interesting research in economics or related disciplines comes from people who have access to the private data collected by the Census Department. You know, they have their census surveys, or by the IRS with the tax records, where if you're an employee of one of those agencies, you can get access to much more fine-grained data than is released publicly. And so often the key to having a really breakthrough economics paper is to have a connection at one of those agencies, add one of those people as a co-author on your paper, and then you can do much more fine-grained research than you can if you're just looking at the data that's publicly released by these agencies.
Yeah, that I think that's right. And this creates a lot of the problems that Pratik mentioned in terms of non-reproducibility. And it also creates potential conflicts of interest questions. So the fact that, you know, let's say, you know, if I want to go to a company and use their data, does that limit my ability to ask certain questions? Let's say, for example, I want to do research about fake news on Facebook, hypothetically. And I contact people at Facebook and tell them I'm interested in doing research about fake news. I'd like to come and work with your data. I don't know this for sure, but my guess is that their response will depend in part on the kinds of things that I'm trying to learn. And I think that creates some complexity. I do think, however, another benefit of having researchers inside of these companies and working with these companies and publishing is that it makes it more clear what's happening inside of these companies. So I think a great example of this was the emotional contagion experiment that was done as a collaboration between researchers at Cornell University and researchers at Facebook on the data science team. And in this paper, the researchers randomly adjusted the emotional content of people's news feeds and then measured the effect of that on the things they posted subsequently. And this paper was published in a scientific journal so that people were aware of what was happening and what was learned. And there was a very large backlash in public. And one thing that came out of that backlash was it seemed that many users of Facebook were not fully aware that Facebook was running experiments on their newsfeed constantly. And so the more the openness of science can sort of get mixed into the somewhat proprietary nature of some of these companies, I think that as a potential benefit to science, to the companies, and to society.
Right, I completely agree with that. I think a broader implication of Matt's comment is that there are some very interesting questions to be asked at the intersection of data use and privacy and individual liberty and accountability. So we could think about asking similar questions in the context of governments' surveillance of our online communications. So we can make a legitimate argument that for national security and terrorism concerns, there is a need to enforce a certain level of accountability and data collection on our communications. And how do we balance that need with individual liberty and user privacy? So one bad way of doing it would be an architecture that would enable mass surveillance without any transparency, without any auditability, while some more reasonable ways of getting to this goal would be approaches that enforce transparency and how this data is not only being collected, but how this data is being used. Notions of auditability, such that external trusted entities can verify that indeed the data use practices conform to what is being publicly stated, but also technical architectures that enable surveillance to be more targeted as opposed to allowing for indiscriminate surveillance.
All right. Well, we're going to be talking about these issues a lot more in March in Berlin at the Fund Global Forum. So listeners who are interested in these issues, I would encourage them to sign up for that. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to WooCast. The content discussed in this podcast is intended to be informational only. It does not represent nor reflect the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.